Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
Hello, hi, welcome. It's Radio K's Real College Podcast. I'm Patrick Sharkey. And to start today's show, we're going to start with just a list of items. And it's up to you, the listener, to guess what these things have in common. Here we go. Rotary telephones, a phonograph, the 3.5-inch floppy disk, something called a ditto machine. What do all these things have in common? Well, today's show is all about relics of the past, this seemingly ancient technology and mechanical processes or art forms, which, through advancements in technology or the evolution of popular culture, probably should have long ago been exorcised from our world, and yet, the faithful few who prefer doing things the old-fashioned way remain. I think there's something charming about doing things the old-fashioned way, so on today's show, we're going to hear from a few people who agree with me. And, by the way, a ditto machine was the first version of a photocopier, which, let's be honest, has become a bit of a relic itself. Our first story comes from Jackie Renzetti as she takes us down to the Mississippi River and explores the melodramas of old. And then later, Hannah Weichel meets up with a couple Twin Cities artists who have modernized the use of printing presses and stamps. Okay, it's the Real College Podcast. Let's do it.
For decades, University of Minnesota theater students have performed 19th century melodramas on an old-fashioned riverboat docked on the Mississippi.
It's been such a big tradition in the University of Minnesota Theater Arts and Dance department. You know, coming in as a freshman, you see pictures and you hear stories about students that have done it for years and just had really, really great experiences.
That was Olivia Willis, one of the 16 cast members in this year's production called Under the Gaslight. She says the crew and cast spent 4 weeks in rehearsal before a run of 60 shows.
And, you know, we get paid. It's really a professional gig, and it's a lot of our first times doing that. So to be able to do it as a part of the university is really special.
And after 57 years, the curtains may have closed Saturday night for the last time.
It's a long, rather complicated story, but ultimately it comes down to money.
That was Marcus Dilliard, head of the Theater Arts and Dance Department. He says the showboat was set up to be entirely self-funded by ticket sales. This worked for a while, but ticket sales have declined since 2008. And when the sales can't cover costs ranging from costumes to driftwood removal, the money has to come from the department's overall budget.
So if we lose money on the showboat, that means we can do less here at Rarig. So what we were hoping for was for the college or the university to help us find, you know, whatever, an outside donor or a source of funding from within the university that would provide just the maintenance part of the cost of operating the showboat.
But that funding never came to fruition, and the operational costs have just become too much for the department. And before money became such an issue, theater faculty have regularly discussed whether the melodramas are in line with the department's mission.
Riverboat melodrama can be a little problematic at times because those scripts are generally over 100 years old. You know, and that was a very different time in the United States. So there are questions that come up about race, class, gender that need to be addressed very carefully. The script for this summer's production was drastically adapted in order to take care of some of those issues. So that's the sort of thing where it sometimes, depending on the play, and to a lesser extent, depending on the director, it becomes potentially a production that strays a little bit farther from the department's mission.
This fall, a contract between the university and the city of St. Paul to dock the boat ends, and so does the contract with Paddleford, which operates the boat. But the university's Board of Regents will continue to own it for the time being.
I'm hopeful. I think that there's a chance, and I don't know the details about any of this, so this is more or less speculation on my part, but there's a chance that the showboat might stay where it is and that the department might have some sort of future relationship with whomever, whichever entity winds up operating, owning and operating the showboat.
Marcus says that if the department does continue providing entertainment on the showboat, there's a range of possibilities for what the programming could be.
But with any luck, it'll stay there, and we might be able to continue producing on it.
Billed as the farewell season, Under the Gaslight has been sold out since July. It was also the very first show produced on the showboat in 1958. The melodrama was written in 1867 by Augustine Daly and even includes someone being tied to railroad tracks at one point.
I was about to tell you, miss, that a man has forced himself in at the front door and asked to see you, but will give no name. Throw the rascal out!
Throughout the drama, audiences are encouraged to boo or cheer on characters. The interactive nature is pretty popular among audience members.
We like to boo and hiss. It's always good.
The show's drawn a dedicated audience over the years. Actors say they've noticed familiar faces from former showboat students or longtime showgoers.
You know, we started going to showboat way back in the 60s and on and off over those years. So it's one of those bittersweet moments. You know, it's too bad that it's going. Maybe it can be resurrected. I don't know. It's one of those things.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Jackie Renzetti.
I thought that I was dreaming when you said you loved me. Start of nothing, I had no chance to prepare, I couldn't see you coming. The start of nothing, ooh, I could hate you now. It's quite alright to hate me now. When we both know that deep down, the feeling still deep down is good.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emily LePain, bringing you this week's Word on the Street. Guided by Voices will be playing First Avenue on August 31st with special guest Bronco. Doors open at 7:30 for this 18-plus event. 22 years ago, in 1994, schoolteacher Robert Pollard and his band recorded B-1000, which became an enormously influential and improbable rock classic. After 22 albums, 24 solo records, and countless side projects, Pollard has recorded a new Guided by Voices album by himself and assembled a new GBV lineup for touring. From their album B-1000, here's the song I Am a Scientist. Hemmingbirds will be playing at the 7th Street Entry on September 1st with special guests Wild Age and Mike Mamone. Doors open at 7:30 for this 18-plus event. Hemmingbirds came into fruition through the scattered collection of songs by Yoo Soo Kim, who bunkered down and hashed out 10 recordings that became Hemmingbirds' debut album, Death Wave. The group then created their second record, The Vines of Age, a conceptual album about battling personal demons, one's future self, and reality. Their latest release, Half a Second, reflects on fleeting moments of life and was released in February of 2016. From Half a Second, here's the song Mess of Things.
Mm-hmm.
Sleigh Bells will be playing at the Fine Line Music Cafe on September 3rd with special guest Tiny Deaths. Doors open at 8 p.m. for this 18-plus event. The Brooklyn-based duo known as Sleigh Bells emerged in the fall of 2009 with rhythmic pop songs combining overdriven guitars and sugary sweet female vocals. The band's most recent critically acclaimed album, Bitter Rivals, was released in 2013. From their album Reign of Terror, here's the song Demons. That's it for this week's Word on the Street. For Real College Podcast, I'm Emily LePayne.
Our generation is part of the digital age. We are accustomed to lifting open our laptops and interacting with digitized images and words. But before computers, there was movable type, like typewriters. And before typewriters, if you can even imagine a time that long ago, there was block printing. But bygone is the era of carving wooden blocks into images and characters to fit a page. Or is it? This week, I spoke with two artists in the Twin Cities who use variations of printing as their art form of choice. Lizzie Christian is a young woman who works out of uptown Minneapolis. She draws, then carves images into rubber to make prints. Ben Levitz, the owner of Studio on Fire in St. Paul, oversees a production-intensive printing press.
We moved in here back in November of last year and started a specialty print shop. We do letterpress, engraving, foil stamping. It's all pressure-based printing, so that's what makes it unique. It's also what makes it production-intensive.
Studio on Fire occupies a warehouse that houses over a dozen vintage letterpresses. Levitz said that for this type of printing, the methods and machinery haven't changed much at all over the years.
The equipment that we're using is actually, you know, 1950s, 1960s vintage Heidelbergs. That was really as far as letterpress technology ever went. And we use that equipment in the way it was originally intended, as printing equipment. The equipment that we use is really big physical equipment. You're talking about a lot of these presses weigh, you know, many, many tons, and, you know, we take up a 15,000 square foot facility, and, you know, there's a lot of heavy iron swinging back and forth every day.
Levitz said they work with the designs their clients come to them with and use that as a jumping-off point for their artistic process. They customize designs with special inks, paper, and finishes and create things like business cards, coffee labels, LP packaging, and coasters.
We're using a light-sensitive plastic, so it's exposed under UV light, and, you know, like emulsion, you're exposing something that then becomes the image with a negative. And then that plastic is super hardened and goes on press and inks up as a relief plate, just like old wooden metal type does.
Levitz's production methods are pretty intensive and can only be accomplished with the right machines. The plastic relief plates they use have so much pressure behind them that when they press down on paper, it leaves a shallow indentation under the inked design. Lizzie Christian does her printing a little differently. She works off the dining room table in her apartment and uses little in the way of machinery.
Yeah, so what I do mainly is carve rubber, and then sometimes I make small stamps, and sometimes I make bigger prints that are kind of rectangular or square and do printing that way.
Christian is resurrecting block printing with her little art business called Rare Press, for which she is the sole artist. The type of prints she makes requires little space and minimal equipment. A soft piece of thick rubber, a few carving tools, ink, paper, and she's off.
I really enjoy the like surprise element of it. When you start carving, you don't always know what it's going to end up like. Even if you plan really hard, it's always a little bit different than you expect, and it's usually better than you expect, so I really like that element of it.
Instead of binding herself to letters and words, Christian's carving tools usually produce the faces of women with big hair and expressions of indifference. She shares her artwork on Instagram and sells some of it online. Last year, she says she made back all of her production and material costs by selling her prints to people who are picking up what she's putting down.
That's a hard balance, and I'm like really new to all this, so I feel like I do a lot of stuff for myself and just kind of hope other people will like it too.
So there you have it. Artful press printing is not dead. And Christian Levitts don't look like they're starving to me. So next time you have a cool print design in mind, maybe try carving it out of rubber. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Hannah Weichel.
This week on the University of Minnesota campus, I asked people if they could choose which time period they would be born in, what would they choose, and why?
I think the medieval would be very cool because I love all the ancient stuff and the dresses that they wore then. And it's sometimes when I go around and see the city, I just imagine how it looked like 100 or two or more than 100 years ago. That would be very cool.
I'm from India, and India got independence in 1947. So whenever I hear stories about freedom fighters, they made India proud and they made India free of the clutch of British. So I would love to be born at that time, like early 90s, so that I can contribute to the freedom fighting. Since I have born at this time and I'm doing PhD now here, so after completion of my PhD, I want to go back to India and serve my nation in what way I could.
I think that I would like to experience the 60s because it was an era where people were more open-minded and they were free when we see how they were dressed, like. From my country in Morocco, in the 60s, there were women that dressed with skirts, and they were really open-minded. Whereas now, there's a different kind of vision of what we see about the culture, etc., and about the media now.
My answer would be about 2030, because I want to see how the world has developed and how what I'm doing right now is impacting the world in a better way.
The 20s, for sure, because definitely the music is my favorite part of that era. And maybe the clothes.
I'd want to be in the future because there'd be like flying cars and stuff.
I'm from an island nation, so I think when I consider a time period, I would go back to the 60s or 70s, because that's when life was simple, no vehicles, just the simple island life, living in a hut, going to the beach and everything. So I think that's a time period I would choose because of the simplicity of life.
Well, I think I like the modern, maybe in the future, if I choose the period, I think I like the modern one, the future one. Well, everything easy, I mean, automatically, anything will be done automatically. I think I like that.
Probably now, like, I mean, this time period, it's great to be here, like, 21st century. Everything's super convenient. You got phones, you got transportation and everything. And, I like where and when I am now.
That's it for Radio K's Real College Podcast this week. It was a short one, but boy, was that a good time or what? Real College Podcast is produced by Jackie Ranzetti, Emily LePaine, and Max Fuller. The show is edited by me, Patrick Sharkey. And my thanks to Hannah Weichel, Emily LePaine, and Jackie Ranzetti for contributing to today's show. We've got a full brand new show next week. That's right, we're just firing on all cylinders here at the Real College Podcast. So be sure to tune in at 6 p.m. on Sunday on RadioK.org, or tune your dial in. How fun could that be? And be sure to subscribe to our show on iTunes. Just search for Real College Podcast in iTunes, or really any sort of podcatcher that you choose. You can also search on Google. We're everywhere, man. We've got a Facebook page. So find us. Be our friend. And be sure to follow us. We've got a lot of fun shows coming up in the next few weeks. Back to school starts soon, and we're going to have a fun little show for that, too. So thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Patrick Sharkey for Radio K's Real College Podcast. Signing off. That's not volunteering, that's a job.